Welcome to the Philia podcast. Philia means daughter. We are the daughters of the women who came before us, and we fight so that our daughters may be free. We are a women-led volunteer organization. Our vision is a world free from patriarchy, where all women and girls are liberated. We seek to contribute to the women's liberation movement by building sisterhood and solidarity among women, locally, nationally, and globally. By amplifying the voices of women, particularly those less often heard or purposefully silenced, and by defending women's human rights. Our podcast seeks to shed light on some of the most pressing issues facing women and girls around the world. Please take from them what you can. In sisterhood and in solidarity, the Philia team. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Philia podcast. My name is Raquel Rosario Sanchez, and I am the spokeswoman for Philia. Today, we are delighted to be speaking with Margaret Owen, who is a human rights barrister and is right now participating in a hunger strike to try to raise awareness to the human rights violation committed against Nazanin Zangari Radcliffe. Nazanin is an Iranian and British dual citizen who has been detained in Iran since 2016. She has been accused by the Iranian government of plotting to topple the Iranian government. Human rights campaigners around the world are insisting that this is an arbitrary detention and that this is a political issue. Nazanin's husband, Richard Radcliffe, have just ended a weeks-long hunger strike. And today, and Margaret, who is going to be speaking with us today about taking on, continuing the hunger strike to raise awareness about Nazanin and her family's plight. Margaret, you wrote a letter to The Guardian, and it's a brief letter. And you wrote, "At 89, I am on a hunger strike for Nazanin Zangari Radcliffe." And you wrote, they shortened your letter, but the bit that was published said, "We cannot allow Richard Radcliffe's ending of his courageous 21-day hunger strike to be the end of the publicity urging the government to pay his long owed debt so that Nazanin and the other hostages return home. Thus, many of us across the country are on a hunger strike in his place for limited days to keep this injustice in the spotlight. I am now on my third date and in my 90th year. I can't see what else I can do." Now, Margaret, today is your fourth day on the hunger strike. Can we begin by addressing what your hunger strike is about? Why do you feel so passionately about Nazanin and her family's plight?
Well, she's Nazanin. And most human rights crises, humanitarian disasters, incredible injustices all over the world don't have an immediate and ready solution to resolve them. But this one does. It's about repaying the debt. And why I am on hunger strike is that I visited Richard several times as he camped for 3 weeks outside the Foreign Office and didn't eat for 3 weeks until he actually did get, well, very nearly quite ill. And then he finished it. And I am really frightened that because he has stopped his hunger strike, which he had to do for the sake of his little girl, Gabriella, and he'd promised Nazanin in, and he'd promised his mother and his family that he would not allow himself to get ill because that little girl needs him. And I started the hunger strike and asking lots of other people across the UK to join me, hoping that we would get media coverage, that we would actually keep this appalling tragedy in the news. There was a lot of publicity for the 3 weeks, and there was a lot of publicity when he ended it. But since then, there have been other really worrying developments that should be in our newspapers, on our television, on our radio.
What do you mean by developments?
I mean particularly Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. Extraordinary, Liz Truss is not only our foreign secretary, she's also Minister for Women and Equalities. So she should be really taking this on. But they have been really not just incompetent, but callous. And really, they have much to blame for what is happening. Because if you people remember that it was Boris, when he was foreign secretary, that was responsible lot for pulling the noose round Nazanin's neck when completely wrongly he told people that she was in Iran because she was training journalists. Well, that was completely wrong. None of us know why he said that, because she was not there working at all. She went there to take her little girl to see her parents in Tehran. And then I'm afraid he also told, when he was a foreign secretary, he also said that we would pay back the debt. So he'd actually said he would. And now, even recently, he's been telling in a Commons committee, there are a whole lot of reasons why we can't pay the debt because of sanctions. Well, actually, it's also been held in the International Court at The Hague that because the debt, which is for these 400 million, which is for these tanks, actually that debt occurred before the sanctions. So it's not ransom money either. It's paying a debt. And also, it's not just Nazanin. There are other dual nationals in the prison in Iran. And all he has got to do is to pay the debt. And I am disgusted. I have to say this. I'm disgusted with Boris, who none of the Tory ministers have, even in that 3 weeks when people were coming to visit him as he camped outside the Foreign Office, not one Tory minister have been to see him. Boris could have easily have walked around the corner from his extremely expensive refurbished flat to speak to him, but he has not done that.
Can you explain?
So I'm on this hunger strike. I won't go on until I'm ill. I'm nearly 90, so I shall have to stop it maybe on Monday or Tuesday. Trying to get the press or television or some people to keep it in the spotlight, because I really worry for Richard Ratcliffe, an incredible, brave and courageous man, that he did this hunger strike, slept in that tent in the freezing cold for 3 weeks and nothing's happening. And also he had a meeting with James Cleverly, one of the ministers in the Foreign Office, but they all say, oh yes, so we're really sorry, but they're not doing anything. There's something they can do. And they, after all, it can go back to Iran, that money. Okay, It can go back as humanitarian aid. They could pack up a box. In fact, the other day, I think 2 days ago, he said he was thinking about whether they could pack huge boxes with lots of medicines or humanitarian aid to Iran. This is what the Americans did. That's how the Americans got their hostages back. They got their hostages back. We should get ours back.
Thank you, Margaret. Can you explain to our audience how does the debt to Iran connect to Nazanin and the other hostages?
Well, they're using that. They're hostages. That's they being used as pawns. The Iranians are saying, we're not, you haven't paid the debt. So they're using them as hostages. Well, actually, using hostages is against international law anyway. It's not, we can't do anything about that, but we know that if we pay back that debt, they will be free. And what I really worry, of course, there are other ones that any day now, she's now been given another 1 year in Evin prison. Evin prison is one of the worst prisons in the world, particularly to be a woman in. And any moment now, she's been charged again with being being a spy and so on. And the Iranians don't even recognize dual citizenship. So for them, she's an Iranian. And any moment now, she will be summoned back to spend another year in prison. And we are all desperately worried about her physical and mental health if she should go back.
She was sentenced in 2016, and it was a 5-year sentence for allegedly plotting against the government. So does that mean that it ends, is supposed to end next year? What do you mean she's meant to go back?
Yes, she has to spend, she was then charged again, after she came out with that one, she's been given another sentence of 1 year in prison and another year before she's able to leave the country, another 2 years.
And she was only in Iran, so her daughter, Gabrielle,
went to Iran to take her little girl, Gabriella, so that little Gabriella could meet her grandparents. That's why she went. She was never doing any work there. In fact, she's a charity worker. She's not doing anything like that. This is what they did with the other dual nationals. There are others as well from here who are dual nationals who are actually in prison. So although this is it's particularly about Nazanin, it's also about the others. I think there are two or three others that have to come home whose families are in agony here, so worried about them. And I know a lot about Iran because I also work for the National Resistance of Iran. So I know what the conditions are like in the prisons. Yeah. I'm really, really fearful. I'm fearful for her. I'm also very fearful for Richard, who has just been so amazing and patient and incredible. But, in this 5 years since 2016, you'd hardly reckon. I mean, you can see he's aged hugely, on the strain of this. I mean, it's a shocking thing. And what is so disgusting is that Boris Johnson is responsible for this being even worse. For the moment he said that she was there training journalists, well, that gave the Iranians all the fuel they needed to arrest her. Do you see?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. He has never apologized. He hasn't apologized. He hasn't even been to see Richard.
Yes.
So what can I do? I can't do much about what's happening to women in Afghanistan, what's happening to women in Iraq, what's happening to the people, all those families who are Kurds. I work on the Kurds who are camping on the Polish-Belarus border. But I can do, this is something we can all do. We have to keep it in the spotlight that this government must repay. What is ironical, I have to say, with all the sleaze in the last 2 weeks, all the vast amounts of money, all those peers and Tory MPs have earned, that could contribute, if there was any problem, to actually pay back the debt. I mean, this is so awful. Yeah. 400 million, you know.
Yeah.
And it's something that we owe. We owe it. And I think one of the other excuses was, but when they ordered those tanks, which never, so they paid us for the tanks, that was at the time of the Shah. So we're not giving it back because it's another regime. Well, that doesn't hold water at all. And in fact, the International Court at The Hague has said that this is a debt that must be paid back. They've said it at The Hague as well.
Well, regardless of the debt issue, she's been held as a political prisoner with no evidence to back up the idea that she
was... There is no evidence. There's no evidence at all. I want to say something also. I mean, they have got a most wonderful, wonderful MP. That's Tulip Siddick, who's absolutely incredible. And she had a debate in the House of Commons on Tuesday afternoon. But again, at the very last moment, she was told by the clerks at her debate on Nazneen, she was told that she mustn't mention the debt because it was sub judice. And she couldn't. And they said, you can't talk about it because it's already in the court case in Iran. But that was, well, as a lawyer, I'd say, that seemed to me rather spurious, and I wish that she had asked the speaker, and then the speaker would have decided whether she could speak about it. But there we are, and I just, this is not about me, it's about Nazneen, and I can't bear it because everybody is saying to me, oh, aren't you amazing? On the hunger strike. No, what's amazing is Richard Ratcliffe and his family and his incredibly brave little girl. And all we're trying to do is to make, I mean, anything that you can do, that Filia can do, to actually get, you know, The Guardian should be doing another article. Channel 4 should be talking about it. Newsnight, you know, today I've sent it to everyone, even Woman's Hour, and nobody's picked it up.
It's not about you personally, but it is about how there's a plight that is happening to a group of people, including Nazneen. And it's about how campaigners such as yourself are taking the mantle to continue shedding a light on it. So
trying to take the place of Richard Ratcliffe, you know, we need to fill that space that he made for us. Yes.
So you mentioned that you wanted to camp with Richard, like Richard, outside of these offices, and you wanted to have a tent, you wanted to have a share blanket, and that the police did not allow you. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Obviously, I couldn't. I mean, I don't know how they did it, but you know that you can't possibly go and camp outside the Foreign Office. You'd be moved away immediately, you know. So that was impractical. But I think that what I missed doing, and maybe we still got to do it, I didn't have the time to organize it. I think we do need to have another big meeting of as many women. Well, mostly they will be in London. I thought this was very sort of London-centric in a way, all the people who came to visit every day outside the Foreign Office. But actually, I wanted people all over the country, Northern Ireland, Wales, you know, Scotland to support. And I think what we might have to do, but I hope we can do this. I'm also the co-chair of the International Working Group of the UK Civil Society Women's Alliance. And so through them, I hope we could maybe maybe we've got to try and organise a big meeting outside Downing Street. I need a lot of help to do that. I'm not sure how I could get that together, but I think that's what we've got to do, because by Tuesday, I know I must stop my hunger strike, because I might get ill, you know.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about how you went about the process of starting this hunger strike? You said that did you visit research?
Yes, I visited several times.
And how was it?
Well, he's just amazing. And I also went on Friday. There was the Friday, his last night, the Friday before last, there was an incredible candlelit vigil. And there was a hymn sheet, and we all sang songs. And then I sat with him, and you'll see that, you know, there's a picture of me on my Facebook. And also I'm tweeting a lot on Twitter. And I told him that we would do this, that we would not let it go into the long grass, that we would keep on, you know.
What did he say to you when you spoke with him?
I asked him what's going on, and he told me about the meeting they'd had with James Cleverly. He said he felt absolutely deflated by it. They were all nice and kind, but nothing happened. It didn't do anything. And that was very depressing for him. And of course, and then I did ask him, because Gabriella, who's now 7, is such a gorgeous little girl and was there dancing and singing. And I said to him, but Richard, you're just the amazing father, because, you know, she looks so happy. And he said something very interesting. He said, because she was so tiny when all this started, she had sort of normalized it. Whereas if she'd been older, she would have understood more, and it would have been more traumatic. And then he laughed and said, well, she's always telling me what an awful father she was. And also she was grumbling because he hadn't shaved for 3 weeks. And she said his beard was so bristly. But I mean, he has done absolutely brilliantly with that little girl. And there's a wonderful family, but he promised Nazanin, and he'd promised his mother, and he'd promised his sister and all his family that he would not go on till he got ill. I mean, he's still having tests in hospital. He went straight when he finished it on Saturday, and there was a big farewell for him on the Saturday. He went straight to hospital. I mean, he walked up, but he was taken straight to hospital to be sure that none of his organs have been damaged by this very, very long. 3 weeks is a long time. And I know a lot about hunger strikes, because I'm also work very much on the Kurdish issues in Turkey, where people are dying because they've gone on for 228 days. Also in Wales, there were hunger strikers for the Kurds who have died. So some of my Kurdish friends have been saying to me, don't do it. But I'm not doing it a long time. I'm not stupid, and I'm not going to overburden the overburdened NHS by getting ill. So I will definitely have to stop on Tuesday. I'm already feeling a little bit dizzy, but I'm drinking lots of water with lemon juice and sugar, and that should keep me okay.
Is it a complete hunger strike? Like no food, but also like the liquid juices or stuff as well?
I don't eat anything. I'm just drinking water. And I had to do it because I said I'd do it. So I'm in a sense, I can't stop it because I said I would do it. I said I would do it only for a few days, because none of us want to, get ill, and then, you know, the NHS is overstressed anyway. That would be a stupid thing to do. So I just want it to be staggered that there's always somebody somewhere hunger striking, you know. I mean, I can do it again in, if she hasn't come back, I'll do it again in a month's time. But oh, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work, Raquel, unless it's picked up by the media. Do you see? And why I did it, because at nearly 90 years old, that is perhaps it more interesting than if because of my age.
Yeah. And still the media has not wanted to pick it up, or not enough media. Can you confirm, is she currently under house arrest in her parents' home in Tehran, or is she in the Evans?
No, at the moment, she is still with her parents, in her parents' house in Tehran. But she's waiting, but they have told her that she's been sentenced to another year in prison. So at this moment, she's waiting for the summons, which could come any day.
And you have talked about how Evin prison is one of the worst places in the world for women to be. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening to women at the Evin prison in Tehran, please?
Oh, it's so terrible. Of course, there are masses and masses of people in prison because anybody who protests the regime could be arrested and put in prison. And even when there were huge protests last year, and they were protesting because there was no electricity, no food, you know, all of that, all those people got arrested. And they are executing. They have executed more people in the last 2 years than ever since the 79 revolution. And what is more, when they execute women, they rape them before they are executed so that they will not go to paradise. They're executing teenagers. There's torture in prison. It's absolutely, they are terrible, terrible prisons in Iran. If women, and also if women, there's a whole vice squad, if women aren't completely covered up, if they've got show any hair or their painted fingernails or anything, they can be arrested in the street because they're not completely, you know, covered up. So that it's a terrible place for women. Well, it's a terrible place for men, for everybody, because this is a terrible, extreme regime that's also exporting terrorism all over the world. Now we are trying to talk to Iran to get this nuclear deal back. So again, we're more focused on that than trying to get these people free. But this is something that's so, I mean, I don't know any other case of violations of international law or a humanitarian crisis or injustice like that. For example, we can't do anything about all the political prisoners in Turkey and all the women who are getting, you know, long 30-year prison sentences who are tortured in Turkey's jail. We can't do anything about it, although we protest and we campaign. But this Nazanin case, we can do something about it. It's clear. We have to pay back that debt. And he said that we were paying back that debt. And now he's prevaricating again. Now he's messing about. This is on Boris's shoulders. It's on, and he is culpable. It's his fault.
By him, you mean Boris Johnson, the prime minister.
Yes.
You said that you were incensed at the betrayal by this government. Do you see any possible changes in their position? Because Richard's hunger strike lasted 21 days. There was significant media coverage. There were many MPs and figures within the Labour Party, including the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, who did visit Richard. Do you think that the UK government might shift their stance following not only Richard's hunger strike, but the hunger strikes taken by people like you following that?
Well, what is incredible, yes, all the Labour MPs, Labour peers, all sorts of people came. Keir Starmer came as well. Not one Tory minister came, not one. Well, I hope so. And I hope I'll get an interview on Channel 4. I hope we've just got to use everything we can. Yes, the Labour Party absolutely are pressing the government to pay that debt. So there we have a government that is barely listening to us. I mean, we can't go into that. That's another conversation. But I do find that Jonathan Friedland's article last Saturday was absolutely brilliant about, through looking at what's happening about Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, it actually is a sort of lens on the whole way that this government is behaving. When we look at everything from Priti Patel and how she is breaching international law, refugee convention, the bill that they're about to bring in. I mean, you could go on and on about also on and on listing. So when we look at the Nazanin case, it also just reflects the incredible way this government is behaving in an authoritarian manner now, authoritarian manner. And it's very sad for me at my age, because I lived through everything. I lived through the Second World War. I lived through all the excitement of that Labour Party victory in 1945, when we had the NHS, we had our education bill, we had the welfare state, and all that is now under the Tory government since 2010. It's all being undone. That time, I have to add, we truly had, the UK had a really good reputation for respect of the rule of law and for compassion. When I think about the kinder transport and all the children that came from Nazi Germany just in the 30s, but we always had that reputation. And what is more, and this is Philia and your wonderful organization working for women, in 2010, when the coalition came to power, it was they who got rid of the Women's National Commission, which, when we went to New York to the Commission on the Status of Women, our Women's National Commission was really admired. But the Tories got rid of it. And there's a very important international convention, the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the CEDAW. And we are even breaching that. We have not domesticated it. They've told us to fill the gap left by the Women's National Commission. We haven't done it. Instead, we've got this, but it doesn't have any statutory backing. We have the UK Civil Society Women's Alliance, but it has no statutory backing, so nobody takes any notice of us if we write to ministers. So this is really, really upsetting that we've lost our moral compass. And also, I just want to add, it's just a suspicion, but all these dual nationals are, I wonder if there's even a tiny little glimpse of some racism here, because I can't imagine that if they were middle-class white English people kept as hostages, I'm pretty sure that they would be, this debt would be paid and they would be out. They would have got them out, just like the Americans got out their hostages. Yeah. So I'm a bit worried about that one.
Yeah, I agree. I have a question. Have you ever talked with Nazanin?
No, I've never met her. I only met Richard once all this began. I never met her, but I met now the wonderful little girl.
Yeah,
and I met his wonderful brother-in-law, who's a doctor, who has been very involved, was there all the time. And I just feel I know Richard now, because I think I visited about four times
yes.
and talked to him.
So when you speak, I think about how dehumanizing this experience, this situation is for everyone who has been held hostages in this manner. So I wonder, based on your conversations with Richard and with Gabriella and her, is it her brother-in-law? What is she like?
I never met her. But you know, you can see how absolutely beautiful she is. And she had lots of really interesting jobs. She's incredibly intelligent, absolutely lovely. I mean, I never met her, but we can all see just from her face and all the pictures of her and what a happy family they were. And she came to, and then I think she met Richard. They got married in England. They got married in Winchester. And she came, you know, she met him soon after she got here. And all his family absolutely adore her, you know. She's just, I know, I don't need to. And I think she's really, really bright, really, really bright. And a good, good person. I mean, you know, you can see, but what is so terrible there, I have to say something else. I hope you don't mind how outspoken I am in my old age. But to deprive that little girl of her mother for so many years. And there is Boris with, we don't even know how many children he has. So he ought to know something about, you know, what the needs of children. I just think it's so absolutely terrible what he's doing. You know, as he goes off on his lovely expensive holidays, God knows who paid for them, whether they're in Moustique or on the Algarve, having his lovely, lovely time, cracking his jokes. And this terrible thing is going on that he could resolve in a minute.
He brings home the injustice of the situation when you can picture, you know, this is just a woman who has a daughter, who has a family. She's a bright woman who had all these interesting jobs. She used to work in the charity sector. And then her life has been sort of put on hold by something that has nothing to do with her. She was just visiting her parents so that they could meet her daughter. I wanted to speak with you a little bit before we finish the interview about your own work, because you're a barrister and you're a human rights barrister, and you have received an OBE for your contribution to women's human rights, particularly for the work that you do around widows' rights. And you have been a participant at the UN Commission on the Status of Women, where you focus also on widowship issues at the United Nations. Can you tell us a little bit about your work?
My work, well, I'm the president. I was a director of an organization called Widows for Peace Through Democracy. Well, my husband died 31 years ago. I was already teaching, and I was actually teaching Commonwealth judges. And one of them had a very sick baby and kept saying to me, could I help? Because they, and fortunately I had a cottage in the country and my neighbor was the head pediatrician at a hospital in Salisbury. And they had a very sick baby that they couldn't, they needed to get into hospital, but they were magistrates, not judges. So they weren't very wealthy. They couldn't afford Great Ormond Street. And my lovely pediatrician neighbor said, I will take them. And we invited this lady with her baby to come to London, and then we'd take her to the country. And the first thing she said when she walked into my living room, before she even sat down holding her baby, you mean your husband's brothers let you stay here and keep all these things? And I was I did know something about widows because I'd been head of law and policy at International Planned Parenthood. So I was traveling all over the world on the status of women issues. But I was on my way then as visiting professor to the School of Public Health in the University of Los Angeles to give a course, a master's course on law, women and development. And that's when I, with that rang in my head as I crossed the Atlantic on the plane, and that's when I started finding nobody was talking about widows. And I went then, it's the most neglected of all gender and human rights issues, because widows in so many developing countries, particularly in conflict countries, they are right outside the protection of the law. They are subject to appalling non-state torture, mourning and burial rights. They often have no rights to inheritance or to own land. They are the poorest of the poor, and they are carry stigma. It's terrible to be a widow in these countries. So I started that at the World, at the Beijing, the Fourth World Women's Conference in Beijing. And I've gone on and on trying to get widows onto the international agenda, the Security Council with UN Women, Human Rights Council. And now we're looking at actually the impact of climate change and global warming on widows as well, who will always be the ones that are left behind. So that's what I do. But I also work very much on the Kurdish issue. So I'm a patron of peace in Kurdistan, but I'm now on the arrest list for Turkey. I can't go to Turkey anymore because I've been reporting on the trials and all these unfair trials. And so, you know, we have to, and what really upsets me with this government, Boris and Priti Patel, they call people like us, oh, goody lefty lawyers, as if we're trying to frustrate their policies just because we're bolshy. And actually what we're doing is to try and protect the human rights enshrined in international law that everyone should enjoy. That's what I do.
What a fascinating life, Margaret.
Well, it's difficult because you can't see change happening. And funny enough, at one time before that, I was an asylum immigration lawyer. And I suppose that was the happiest job I ever had, because in those days I could win cases, go to the tribunal, sit on the green velvet sofa of the Minister for Immigration in the Home Office and get decisions using discretion on compassionate grounds. And then I could close a file and I've got a family together, finished a case, won it. But with what I do now, there's no winning. But with this case about Nazneen, we can win if we all come together and somehow put that pressure on. This is something that we must win. It's winnable. Do you see?
Yes. Yeah. And you sound so passionate about it. You have said in the past that you're a lawyer, right? And you think that to be a successful lawyer, you have to have a passion for the truth and a clarity of vision, as well as the power of concentration. So I can see how all of these elements that you use through your legal practice, you're now channeling that to this case with Nazneen. I wonder if you can speak with our Philia audience. What message do you have for them to drive home the message of the Nazneen campaign?
My message to the audience is thank you for listening to me. I do hope that you will do all you can wherever you are to maybe through your members of parliament to write letters to bully and lobby your members of parliament to keep going on this issue, not let it be go under the blankets. And also maybe wherever you are, that you will organize your own mini hunger strikes, your own protests, gatherings, marches, whatever. Don't let this please go away. I need all of you to help me. I feel rather alone, being nearly 90, alone in this house, not eating. I need all of you to do what you can and think of other ways. Maybe I couldn't think what else I could do. That's why I wrote in The Guardian, what more can we do? So it's through our members of parliament. We must say, you know, we vote for them. They've got to listen to us. We've got to make, say, all of them, they have got to keep on at this. They have got to keep badgering the government and ensuring that this debt is paid. Keep Boris to his word. Pick up what he said. I mean, you can Google and find out everything that's happened. You'll Google and find even just the other day at a Commons meeting. He then said, well, I'm now thinking about packing a big crate with humanitarian aid. Well, you know, he says all these things and then he never does it. So I think that's the way. Use your MPs, use all your, you know, whether it's your women's institutes, wherever it is, all the clubs, your book clubs, all the places that you meet people, keep all of them on it. I mean, I'm wearing a badge which says Free Nazanin. You know, you could do lots, I'm sure. And thank you very, very much. I feel really, really worried that even my mini hunger strike will go on till Tuesday. It's just been, I don't want it to be a waste of time. And I'm very, very grateful to you, Raquel, and to Filia for literally giving me an opportunity to talk about it. I cannot thank you enough. Thank you.
Final question, Margaret. If you could speak right now to Nazanin, what would you say to her?
I would say to her, the whole country is working, is on your side. We are all trying to support you. All the women in this country are so distressed at what you are going through. And we love your husband, we love your little daughter, and we all love you, although we've never met you, and admire you so much. And so we pray that whatever is going to happen in the next few months, you know, just keep strong. I know how hard it is. We all know how hard it is, but you will be free. You will be free. It's going to happen. So please keep faith, and we love you and pray for you. That's what I would say.
Thank you very much, Margaret. That's very beautiful. And at Filia, all of us are very keen on seeing Nazanin and the other prisoners who are being held hostage. We look forward for them being released very soon. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. We are incredibly grateful to all the women who donate their time and their effort to create this podcast. That includes our guests, our interviewers, and our editors. You can find us on your favorite listening platforms like Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. Just search for Filia Podcast. Please help us reach even more women. You can do that by subscribing to our show, by sharing this podcast with your friends, with your family, and with your coworkers, and by leaving us a positive rating and review. Philia organizes the largest annual grassroots feminist conference in Europe. We would love to see you there. You can support our work by joining the Friends of Philia scheme, by giving a solidarity ticket so that even more women can join their conference, and by subscribing to our newsletter. Please take a look around our website, philia.org.uk, to find out more. Together, women make magic happen, and we can't wait to be in touch with you.